So thank you, Ron, for the kind introduction. Thanks to the organizers for inviting me to this great place. Hard to work here, I guess, but I think we'll do our best.
You get used to it.
Yeah, good morning to everybody. Yeah, yeah, you get used to it. But for the first 4 weeks, it's tough, I would say. Well, yeah. So, the title came to my mind when I made up my opinion to come here to this place, realizing that the world is certainly shrinking as far as travel is concerned for the last 30, 40 years that I'm traveling around the world. And the tube diameter is, as I hope I can convince you, is certainly shrinking. Tom made a little question mark on that, I think. But okay, we'll see. The first point here is to remind us in what section of the polymer field, polymerology we are looking at. This is the dirty bit. Yeah, polydisperse, polymer melts. I'll say a few words on this. Then I think all of you realize that what is missing in Doy Edwards is tube stretch to describe these polydispersed melts, at least. The explanation we have come up with is then what I try to explain to you, first in terms of something like BKC, and then we introduce some dissipation there to get a steady state. And of course, this is a symposium on open questions. After my conclusion, there will be, of course, two questions I have. Probably you can help me with that. Okay, so polydispersed melts, what do I mean with that? There are, I think, roughly about 100 million metric tons of polymer produced each year. And all of that stuff is polydispersed. Yeah? On the other side, there is probably a production of a kilogram or less of monodispersed material. And even the metallocene catalyzed materials that are so fancy today usually have a MW over MN of 2. And even that material is already hard for processing. So people in the industry now look for what they call user-friendly or processing-friendly metallocene catalyzed materials by adding bimodal distributions or branch polymers or whatsoever. So the polydispersity is quite wide, yeah. And in a sense, I think the monodispersed case, in a sense, is a degenerate case. It's a singular case. While there is a multitude of polydispersed material out there, and I think this community should come to terms with this fact eventually. I mean, it's in 2 years' time, the golden jubilee of the rubber-like liquid. 50 years of continued integrations for polymer melt. And I think we should approach the problem, the real problem, once in a while. It's about time to do that now. The viscosity, the zero shear viscosity of these melts that are on the market usually are in this range, 10 to the 4th to 10 to the 6th Pascal seconds. There are grades with lower viscosities for injection molding, but they're the viscoelastic properties are not that important, really. But for the material for blow molding, fill blowing, anything where you put elongation on it in a free surface flow, you need somewhat the viscosity in that range. Otherwise, the stuff is just either flowing too easily, you can't handle it, or it's so viscous that it will fracture if you do a real processing on it. The two other lines here, the shear rate window that we can faithfully investigate experimentally is somewhere in that range. 10 to the minus 3 to 10 to the 4 reciprocal seconds. That is what we can measure reasonably well these days. You can extend it a little bit by time temperature superposition if the material is thermoreological simple and if you do it correctly. The range is even more restricted in terms of, this is uniaxial elongational strain rate, epsilon dot, The RME is restricted by its software to the range of somewhere 10 to the minus 3 to 1 reciprocal seconds max. And there are only very few missions on MIRTZ which go above that. Martin Laun likes to say that in earlier times people were not restricted by software. So he could make experiments up to 30 reciprocal seconds. You can find some of that published 20 years ago. So that's the experimental range that we can investigate. And that's where we get the knowledge on the material from. I mean, this is, and actually, I mean, what we want to describe is the material, the real material, this ugly stuff. A typical example, and I must admit there are only two well-characterized melts, characterized in the sense that Joachim Meissner and his students have measured not only uniaxial but also equibiaxial and planar extension. It's a linear melt, this one here. And you see uniaxial elongational viscosity, time dependent, equibiaxial viscosity, and the two planar viscosities. Planar one in the direction where you pull, and because in a planar deformation you have to keep this dimension constant, you need a tension here. You divide it by the extension rate in this direction, and this gives you the second planar viscosity, or some people call it the cross viscosity. Okay, that's the experimental evidence we have. You see, the material is strain hardening. Usually people say if, let's say, something like the steady state, or if it rises above the linear viscoelastic startup here, then it's strain hardening. I would not follow that definition. We'll see that in a second. Well, I should also mention that the solid line here is the time-dependent zero shear viscosity, which you get from chi prime, chi double prime. The first test of an experiment is, of course, whether you measure correctly either your linear viscoelastic properties or your extensional data, if you get an agreement of these data. And that's reasonably the case here. Now, how can we describe this stuff? Actually, one of the concerns when Joachim Meissner started out to measure equibiaxial and planar and ellipsoidal deformation was that we might have to characterize a melt in each of these extensional deformations because they're all different. Yeah? And that's certainly a nightmare from an industrial point of view, that you would have to characterize each melt in a multitude of extensional deformations. So one question is, of course, can we do better? Can theory help us to understand how the deformation is influencing the viscosity in different elongations? Okay, now Ron has already mentioned Doy Edwards 78. I prefer the independent alignment assumption, which is, if you analyze these data, is more consistent with the data. It's more consistent with the second normal stress different being closer to 2 over 7 than 1 over 7. The second to the first normal stress difference ratio. This is not only seen in shear flow, but you can, as I have shown years ago, you can also discern that from the comparison of uniaxial and equibiaxial data and from the comparison of the planar 1 to the planar 2 data. And there you find that the orientation tensor, which I write in this form here, just to familiarize you with my notation, the U primes are just the deformed unit vectors. And the average is taken over the isotropic distribution that you start with, is just the orientation tensor here. And you need a factor of 5 or 15 over 3 to get the right connection to linear viscoelasticity. So Ron, I would vote for, if you need a prefactor for the plateau modulus, I vote for 3 over 5, not 4 over 5. Yeah? Because with 4 over 5, you already have a, you make a pre-assumption on the type of deformation of the tube. You say you have a fine deformation of the tube, And I don't think that the tube deformation, even a small deformation, is a fine. So, now, this thing here definitely does not give us any strain hardening. It's just a rotation, what some people call a fine rotation. And if you calculate the Dyer-Edwards result for this melt, taking the linear viscoelastic time constants from linear viscoelasticity, put in the orientation, that's what you get. Okay? And I would argue that the correct comparison, as far as strain hardening is concerned, is not a comparison of this viscosity compared to the linear viscoelastic startup curve, but a comparison between the Dyer-Edwards result and the experimental result, because that gives you the amount of strain the amount of stretching in the chain. Yeah? And as I've shown, you can take these data here and you can decompose it in the sense that you decompose time and deformation. And then you take the deformation part and decompose it in orientation and chain stretch. Okay? And what you find is that chain stretch, as I'll show you for all of these things, is approximately the same. Okay, so we need chain stretch. This is a broad distributed linear polyethylene melt, admittedly. But you see the same thing for any polydispersed melt, like a polystyrene. Yeah, please. The spectrum? Of course I have it. I don't have a, no, I don't have a slide with me, but the data is in the paper. I should say that we published part of the work I present to you in Journal of Rheology December last year, and I have a few copies over there. So what is the question on the spectrum, Sky? The spectrum of terminal times is, for any of these commercial linear melts, is undeterminable. It extends so far that you are not able to measure it experimentally with a certain accuracy. The spectrum I use here extends to, I think, if I remember correctly, 5,000 seconds at 170 degrees, but that's certainly not the end of it. If you would have to make a creep experiment, which would last for 6 hours, 24 hours, and your material is gone by the time you are at that.
So yeah. It would be fair to say that we have chains that are slowly relaxing enough that it's not unreasonable that some of the Rouse times would be
ranging extension. That's the main question. I was sure that this question would come up here. All I can say is I don't see any Rouse time in here. There's no Rouse time that I can discern here. What I see is a spectrum of relaxation time, which certainly has a very long time scale. Okay? Yeah. Well, you can. Yeah, well, you can, this is an extreme case here, because it has a lot of strain hardening here. And the fact that it has a lot of strain hardening is that it's broad molecular weight distribution, it has some high, some very long molecules brought in. But you can take a run-of-the-mill polystyrene melt, where you can find the end of the spectrum, like this one here. Yeah, it probably has the longest relaxation time of a few hundred seconds. Okay, and this is a molecular weight distribution approximately 2.2 probably, and it shows appreciable strain hardening. Yeah, nothing special on these melts. That's how usual polydispersed melts behave in uniaxial and here equibiaxial extension.
Martin Lowen had some polydispersed polystyrene published data on some time ago that seemed to have the same polydispersed disease but without the hardening.
No. You know there's, well, that's the paper by Lowen and Schuch. But at that, they tried to measure just the steady state elongational viscosity, and they didn't find a bump for all of these melts. But I think that was a peculiarity of the particular system they choose. Any one of these polydispersed melt will show strain hardening. Okay? So if you look at these polydispersed melts, you will find strain hardenings, no question about it. And it's also clear that if you reduce the width of the molecular weight distribution, that the amount of strain hardening will be smaller and smaller. And the issue is, that will be the end of my story. Why is it happening? What is the physical origin of it? I don't know. Okay? But just have a look at the data at the moment and try to, let's say, be open-minded of what the material tells us. Okay. So we have strain hardening. And the question is now how to describe it. I think in the book of Dorian Edwards, one of the propositions was to put the stretch in front of the configuration integral and say, okay, let's pre-average it. And this is, I think a lot of people have used that, knowingly that it's, of course, a pre-average operation. And then the issue is, of course, how to get an evolution equation for the stretch, lambda, as they call it usually. And I think this equation was first at least published by the late Dale Pearson after some suggestions from Pino and co-workers. Well, there's a more extensive paper by Dave Mead on that, and certainly some more. And then eventually, I mean, the same structure was used by Tom and Ron on the pom-pom model. It is used here, in my opinion, that you introduce either a rouse time or a stretch relaxation time plus a maximum extensibility for the pom-pom, for the long chain branched materials, which I don't see really in these melts. Okay, so for example, the pom-pom model, for each mode, you have to introduce two additional constants. So if you need eight modes, you have 16 nonlinear constants on top of the linear viscoelastic one. And I don't think that we can say we have understood the problem as long as we need these numbers of constants. Okay? From the data analysis, I think at least we could convince ourselves that actually this stretch should be under the integral, inside the integral. So we call that F, which is the molecular stress function. And from our certainly primitive understanding of the tube model, we would argue that any stretching of a polymer chain in a tube will be accompanied by a change of the diameter. Or the other way around, the only way to stretch a chain is by squeezing on it. That's the simple physical argument here. And this idea brings you immediately to the fact that the F, the inverse relative tube diameter, or the tension of the chain is inside the integral. And as I say, what you can do is you analyze the data and you find that for the experimental range we are looking at, this seems to be a consistent picture. You get the same F or F squared for whatever extensional deformation you look at. It's a little different for the shear part, as we'll see, because in shear you get less stretch, the velocity gradient in shear is not coupling to the orientation. So the amount of stretch you get is limited. And I will restrict myself for the moment to the elongational flows and come only back to shear flow at the end. Pardon me? Well, we at some time we assumed that there is a constant tube volume. That, well, it's an incompressible flow. Yes, of course. We use the usual incompressibility assumption. Yes.
So the tube is extended in one direction, compressing
the
other.
Well, I think that's already a too little picture, too simple picture. I would like to be more flexible in the way I understand the tube. It is a conception that gives us an idea of what is an entanglement or what physics is behind an entanglement in a sense. But I don't think they should take it too literally. The diameter is a scalar, and I think the diameter relates to the energy, the free energy that is in a tube segment. That's what I'm coming now to. So, yeah. Excuse me?
There's a length scale that one can get for a chain under tension. That's
yes.
Sometimes referred to as a Pincus plot. That is, if the length scale under tension starts to matter. Is that what you're referring to? And there's a corresponding diameter. Is that what you're referring to, or is it a different concept?
It's a different concept. I think it's a different concept. What I say here simply is that if you calculate the free energy of a chain segment in a box, yeah, that's what I'll use in a second here. Then I think the shed showed that 1974, 26 years ago, that the free energy of a chain segment in a box is 3 kT times, take the A sub zero squared here as NB squared, N being the number of flexible bonds, B being the Coote step length, and take the A as the diameter of the box. And Marucci has shown that, 81, yeah? And in Doy-Edwards' paper, it's was shown in 78 or 79, that that's a reasonable assumption. Okay? So what I say is, the building block of this simple theory, I can only do simple theories, there a light chalk, yeah. The building block here is an object with a diameter A, okay, and we have N, what do you call these chain segments or steps of length B in this thing. Okay? And the free energy of this thing is 3 kT times NB squared divided by A squared. And now if you start to squeeze on that, okay, the energy will increase. And so I generalize that and say this is 3 kT times, well, you cannot see it any longer. Let's put it down here. 3 kT A sub zero squared divided by A squared. And then we normalize it to equilibrium, minus 1. And then if you use the definition of what we call the molecular stress function, the relative tension of the chain, it is just F squared minus 1, which is close to the classical concept. If you start to stretch, you know, the energy is quadratic in the stretch. Simple, huh? Is it? Okay, so the next step is, of course, how to get an evolution equation. Now, what we have used here is to say, let's assume in first instance there is no dissipation, no non-linear dissipation. There's just relaxation going on, relaxation, linear viscoelastic relaxation continuing, of course. But due to the deformation, there is no additional relaxation process. So the change of the free energy here is equal to the work of the stress tensor. So all the energy that you put into the system is stored on the system. That's this equation here. Df squared dt is equal to the deformation velocity gradient double dotted into the stress tensor. And because we look at one segment, you have to normalize it by the plateau modulus. Using the definition of my strain measure here, this is equal to F squared times the kappa double dotted into the orientation tensor. So that's equilibrium thermodynamics. Any energy put in the system is stored in the system, stored by squeezing. You can solve this equation here analytically, and the result is S squared is e to the average logarithmic deformation. So you get the exponent of the orientational free energy. Okay, so if you put that F back in here, you can convince yourself that you get exactly the orientation tensor back. Is it understandable? Yeah? Okay, now, when we use this F here in our simple equation for this linear melt, then you get the green lines here. And as you see, they describe the onset of this strain hardening quite nicely. So there's no nonlinear free parameter so far. The drawback is, of course, that this thing will go through the roof, because eventually, if you squeeze hard enough, there will be some dissipation coming in. And you see, it works for uniaxial, it works for equibiaxial, it works for planar one, and it also, and that's important, I think, planar one, it also works for planar two, where you don't see strain hardening of that melt. Actually, the Doyle-Edwards result is not too far away from the experimental data. And you can capture this effect here. Okay? Now, to get a steady state, of course. Yeah.
No, sorry. Yes. I just need to know where the elastic fluid is that would drop in there.
The elastic?
Lodge equation.
Lodge equation would give you a strain hardening effect that is stronger than what you observe experimentally. Yeah? And it would, I have a hard time to remember. It will not be able to describe the planar case, at least not, here, this planar case here, because there's no second-normal-stress difference. So that's what you need here to get a description. Yes?
You finish up with them, but...
Yes, I'll do my best. It depends on you, of course, on your questions. To get a steady state, you'd have to introduce some dissipative process. That's a simple energy equation, an energy balance. The amount of energy stored is the amount of energy you bring in, and now you assume that you lose part of that at higher deformations. And that's what we call dissipative constraint release. There are some fine things in here, but you find that in the paper. We assume that the orientational free energy is conservative. Whether that's correct or not is another question. And then you get a stretch potential which has the correct properties. It's quadratic in the stretch, and it has even a pole at F equals to zero. So the question is how to get this thing, and I'll come to that hopefully in a minute. So the second issue, and that is, I would say in a sense intriguing, at least to me. Now, if you see that all linear melts behave in this way here, at least the inception of strain hardening is according to this equation, then you ask yourself, now what about long chain branch melts? And that's the comparison you get for the long chain branch melt. Assuming that they would be linear, you get this type of strain hardening. So long chain branch melts show a stronger strain hardening effect. Okay, so what do we do? Of course, we need a different strain energy function. The one we used here is in the paper, and I'm not going to explain it here. It has some phenological things in it. When you use that, you can describe the inception of strain hardening for, I think we have now investigated about a dozen branched polymer melts, at least in uniaxial extension. You can show that it works for all types of extension. A particular nice case is this long chain branched polypropylene melt, made long chain branched by irradiation. And you see, you can describe it in that experimental window. No nonlinear parameter, except, of course, for the energy, or the assumption of the free energy. We have come up with a more, at least for me, convincing explanation for the strain energy function that we used here by assuming that, very, very simple, if you see, this is the picture for a linear melt. That's a chain segment. You squeeze on it, that's the increase of the free energy of that object, which describes the linear melts, at least for some deformation. Now, a long chain branch run, let's approximate with a simple picture, assuming not necessarily a functionality of four. So if we stretch it, of course, we stretch one of these and we squeeze the other one. So you add the strain energies of this plus this thing here, and you get a strain energy function, which gives you nearly the same result as I have shown you just before. And I'll show you this on some recent data from Martin Laun's lab, just to show you how reasonably we can describe these materials if you have good measurements. These are measurements with the RME, the open symbols here, and the full symbols are with a Münster type, or Sritar type, rheometer, where you just glue the thing in and start with exponential velocity of extension. You see, you get this inception here quantitatively, and if you put the new strain energy function on top of that, it's nearly indistinguishable. Here in this model, we have already put in the dissipative part, and that's, I admit, is the difficult part, and it took us some time to find a suitable formulation. And the formulation that we found is phenomenological, in the sense that we assume that there is a plastic deformation, a plastic dissipation, which gives you the correct properties of the steady state that you find there. Constant strain rate flow, it is a quantity which is d squared double dotted into the orientation tensor, and there's a phenological parameter in front of it, the A1, which for extensional flows is the inverse of the maximum extensibility, and for shear flow we get this beast here. And you can show that these quantities here can be expressed in terms of the second-order Rifelin-Erichsen tensors, just averaged over the orientation. So they are time deformation separable, and they give you about the correct plateau values if you put it in here. You see that the dissipative part only comes in for this brush melt here at very high elongations. Yeah, sometimes in an area where it's difficult to measure anything, because it's quite difficult to measure high extension ratios. Yes? Well, we are not too sure about that. It might be an artificial effect of either the spectrum that we used here, because these low modes here, or these low deformation modes, are sensitive to the long relaxation time tail of the spectrum, which is intrinsically difficult to describe or to find out experimentally. One fact. The other is that it is extremely difficult to measure in this area. But that's, of course, an excuse. I can show you, I can give you a PDF file of a copy of the thesis of my student who did that work here. I can show you, as I say, I guess half a dozen examples of long chain branch melts, where you see that it fits reasonably well. There's still, of course, an area of doubt whether the maximum extensibility is depending on the relaxation mode you look at, or whether it's a universal, for a given melt, a universal property. You see, for this melt here, it looks pretty good. What else do I have got here? Just to convince you that there are two other melts, where I would also say it's not worth to worry about that at this time. These are, I think, tubular produced in tubular reactors. That's an autoclave material. And again, you see, well, in the accuracy of the measurement, it describes it. But I agree, there might be a subtle effect in there, which you could explain by, let's say, different extensibilities of different molecules with different lengths. Yes?
How trustworthy is that turnover experimentally?
Which one? This one?
Yeah, for example, I mean, experimentally, isn't it notorious to become unstable and you get close to fractures? Or can we really believe those overtures?
I would say you have to look at a lot of experiments and do very careful experiments, because you can convince yourself that these things are real, even with an RME. My student took about 2 years before she was able to get reasonable measurements that at least I believed in. It is clear you get fracture on this side here, because usually you find melt fracture or cohesive fracture of these melts at extensional stress of about 1 megapascal. So if you reach a viscosity of 10 to the 6 and you have 1 reciprocal second, you are prone to fracture. And you see that in the data. It's very clear. On this side, of course, if you look at the real data of an RME, you find that the forces are getting so small. Milligrams. Yeah? So if you are not careful and there's a small offset of your transducer, you get exponentially increasing viscosities. You know that, Tom, I guess. Yeah. So it's getting difficult here, and there's fracture here. So you need to look at a lot of data before you convince yourself whether there's really a plateau that you can trust or not. But that's open to discussion. My point is not so much the plateau value here. My point is that I can describe the inception here by just assuming energy storage, BKC. It's BKC up to here, and it's not BKC when you go to the city state. Okay, just to keep Ron happy, let me show as a final graph for the shear, of course. And I restrict that to the to the case of the long chain branch material. You see inception of steady shear flow for viscosity, first normal stress difference, step strain, and what you need in the case of shear flow is not only one parameter, but you need two here, because of the rotation that is in the shear flow. But you, with these two parameters, you can get agreement for all of these data. Okay, now I have to look for my conclusion slide. Okay, so what are my conclusions at least? Yes, I think the tube is shrinking. And I think, really, the general case is tube shrinking. And the degenerate case is a monodisperse melt, where the tube shrinking is restricted to very small values. Okay?
Why?
Pardon me?
Why?
Well, because all melts, all the polydisperse melts, show this type of behavior.
But why should monodisperse melts not?
Well, that's the open question. I'll come to that in a second. I cannot explain it. If you have an answer, Tom, I would be happy to listen. Yeah? That's the open thing, but my argument is that anything that is polydispersed, that is long chain branched, shows the type of tube shrinking that I have shown you here. Yeah, and you can only avoid that, or let's say reduce it to the level where you don't discern it experimentally, in the case of monodisperse melts. So the amount of elastic energy stored in the chain stretching is inverse proportional to the square of the tube diameter. I think that is old, Degen 74. Should not be real an argument. The chain stretching, at least in this experimental window, is deformation dependent. There might be a deformation rate regime where you really approach some Rouse time and get additional stretching. That's possible, but not for these melts. It's not in the experimental window of these melts. The chain stretching is the same for all segments of the melt. So it's really a cooperative property. There's a clear difference in the chain stretching of linear versus long chain branch melts. You can use it to really investigate, at least if there is considerable strain hardening, whether you have a linear melt or a long chain branch melt. And the chain stretching is limited by a dissipative constraint release, but that's only a word, yeah? Constraint release process, which is of the type of a plastic dissipation. And now my open questions, I limit these to just two, just not to look too stupid, yeah? I don't know what the relation between molecular weight distribution and long chain branching is on the one hand side, and these constants A1, or the maximum extensibility of the material, and in shear A2. The only thing I know is if the molecular weight distribution is broad, then A1 will be small, and F squared, which is more or less the inverse of it, will be large. And I don't know what is the exact mechanism of this, what I call dissipative constraint release process. It has to be, the squeezing has to have a limit, and it's somewhere there. Okay, that's my knowledge or not unknowledge or whatever you call that. Thank you.
Then a sort of physics way of doing it would be to start with a controlled bilobal jet.
Exactly.
Now, this in the context of your experiments, Helmut Wunsch did, and his student Jan Kepler has recently done and published. So they have some polystyrene control blends with two molecular fractions.
where a very high molecular weight fraction is added in a few percent.
Yeah.
And they're having central rheology.
Yes.
And central rheology qualitatively does what yours does, except for one very important feature, which is that the linear rheological curve is followed right up onto a plateau for a decade or two in extension rate, and then the extension hardening comes only at extension rates well up onto established plateau. No, because the rates are the inverse of calculated Rouse times for the high molecular weight fraction.
No,
I can't see a mean stress function theory capturing that, because it's not a function of strain, it's strain hardening comes.
Tom, I have not seen these data. I know of. Really? Well, you should give me the reference. But what I know are data of some Chinese, I think Koyama and his co-workers, or probably Takahashi, can't remember exactly. They made blends of monodisperse melts in a similar way, and they found that, of course, the monodisperse has no strain hardening in the original definition, and if you add a little bit of long chain branching, you get this type of strain hardening that you see for any commercial run-of-the-mill polystyrene. Nothing peculiar about it.
Well, that's of course not surprising either from a Rouse stretch point of view, because the Rouse times a long chain branching.
I claim that at least in this experimental window, you don't need a Rouse time. Yeah? Yeah?
Okay.
That's my point of view.
I can make on this is when you put that stretch function inside the integral, you're saying that the time scale of stretching is the same as orientation.
No.
I can see that you have a broad spectrum of molecular weights, then your Rouse spectrum overlaps the orientation spectrum sufficiently that over a range of rates, you blur them together and
well, it does. If you make good experiments, I claim it does not go wrong at the low rates, and it does not go wrong at the high rates.
Well, you didn't actually show us in the example every single plot that you showed us.
Yes.
You fitted the theory with the cutoff overshot the cutoff.
Well, at high extension rates, as I say, you are prone to fracture. So, for example, in this case, you have not reached the steady state.
Yeah.
What do you see here? I would say this is the type of agreement that you can expect from these experiments. And Scott, I'm but that's not the point, as I say. I'm quite happy to say that the plateau here might depend on, let's say, some time scale or some length of the tube, but the region here where your experiments are good, yeah? You don't need a Rouse time to explain this.
Lyndon just informed me that his talk is going to answer all these questions.
No.
Thank you.